but can learn something from the first two, and I developed Charlie Gaia. More recent work that I did with Charlie Gaia at the University of Minnesota, when he was back visiting the Department of Statistics at the University of Washington. Distinguished Lecturer in Statistical Sciences for this year. The ideas I want to talk about today are not the ones that Noel Thompson referred to that I developed with Charlie Gaia, but some more recent work that I did with Charlie Gaia at the University of Minnesota when he was back visiting the Department of Statistics at the University of Washington for sabbatical a year or so ago. And the examples I'm going to try and talk about these ideas in the context of a very classical, very straightforward problem. And the examples that we developed for this talk is work with a current graduate student, Yan Ming Di. First, I want to talk, many of you of course know most of these things, but for those of you who don't, I want to remind you what are latent variables. Latent variables are basically hidden variables, the things that we wish we would see in order to be able to answer scientific questions, test scientific hypotheses, but variables that we cannot see that underlie the variables that we can see. And those arise in many, many areas of sciences, many, many models that are used in scientific inference have some sort of structure where the latent variables are unobservable and we have to say something about the hypotheses that underlie those latent variables from the data that we do see. I work in genetics and genomics, so my examples are all taken from genetics and genomics, but this is not restricted to genetics and genomics. In genetics, they do arise at all levels from the cell right up to the species, and at the most basic level in genetics is the process of meiosis, which is the process that forms the sperm and egg cells that copy the DNA that goes on to the next generation, the basics of inheritance. And meiosis is a fascinating process about which we still know really relatively little because we can't actually see it happening. But what we do know is that at a fairly schematic level, as you all know, individuals have two chromosomes. Chromosomes come in pairs, one from a mother and one from a father. Each chromosome is a double strand of DNA. What happens before meiosis is that these chromosomes duplicate. So here I've drawn two duplicated, a pair of chromosomes, but each one's duplicated. So we now actually have here eight strands of DNA, four double strands. And at that stage, before the DNA goes off to become the DNA in the sperm or egg cell, they can exchange, they're tightly intertwined and they can exchange material. So from this single pair of parental chromosomes, we have four potential chromosomes, one of which will go to an offspring. Now there are many, many, this is a very, very schematic and simple version of the process. There are very many interesting things about it, like where do these things be, where do these six points occur, how does the position of one affect the positions of the other, how does the fact that I've had the exchange between these two copies here affect whether or not this exchange will be between the same two copies or a different two copies, and so on. If I could actually see all four products of meiosis, life would be much simpler. I could test those hypotheses. But basically we can't, we can only test one, we see the one that goes to the sperm or egg cell, we never see jointly all four products of meiosis. So that's one example where we have latent variables. But the next level up, actually when I do look at my offspring chromosome, when I do look at the data, DNA data for example, trait data on an offspring, I can't actually, they're not nicely colored for me, black and white, I can't see exactly where the switch points occur. What we can see is that when DNA is inherited from parents to offspring, that if two positions are very close together, if the, maybe the DNA affecting two traits is close together on the same chromosome, there's going to be a tendency for it to be the same color, black, both white or both black, because I might be either side of the switch, in which case it would be different, but there is going to be dependence in the sense of the same parental chromosome being handed on to the offspring at those two positions. And the dependencies are stronger for the closer locations, and that's what underlies the whole theory of genetic mapping. But again, I don't actually see these nicely colored black and white chromosomes. All I see is some DNA data, some marker data on those possibly, if I'm being stern-sighted, we could get much more information about the meiosis if we could observe all the four meiotic products, but we don't. And we could get much more information about genetic linkage from the data that we observe on related individuals if we could actually observe the colours of those chromosomes at the positions, but we don't. And as I go to the higher levels, which I'm not going to talk about at all today or tomorrow, if we're looking at relationships and individuals on a larger scale, relationships among individuals at the population level, or even variation between species, we don't actually see exactly where the DNA has come, what are the exact lines of descent. If we could, it would be much easier to test our hypotheses about relationships among populations, about the processes of evolution, like mutation and selection, but we don't. They're all latent variables. So latent variables arise everywhere, and the several of the questions that I started to get me interested in this is that when we do make inferences on the basis of the data that we do see, how should we actually take that uncertainty about the latent variables into account when we express strength of evidence and test hypotheses and estimate parameters and so on? In general, as I said, I'm going to talk about it in the context of a very simple example, but in general it's quite complicated. We may have a relatively simple model for our latent variables. That's generally why we set it up in terms of the latent variables, but there may be some straightforward model for the latent variables, but the actual observed data may depend in some quite complicated way and end up with some kind of complicated pattern of dependence among our observed data. And even computing a likelihood or a test statistic can be very hard in this sort of framework in general. Computing a likelihood, that is the probability of the observed data, will in general require summing of all those latent variables over those things I can't see. This can be a very large space. Often we use Monte Carlo, likelihood, just indeed in order to compute the statistic or the likelihood. And even once I've got my statistic or my likelihood, assessing significance can be even harder, because if I need Monte Carlo to assess to evaluate the statistic, to assess the significance of that statistic, I may require Monte Carlo within Monte Carlo, and quite apart from any statistical issues about what we believe about our model and the information in our model, that becomes incredibly computationally intensive. So the ideas that I've been trying to develop with Charlie Geyer, which I think have broad application, although again, these 2 days I'm only going to talk about them in a fairly narrow context, is basically a new way to get p-values, assess significance in these sorts of problems, and a way that along with assessing significance gives us a way to express the uncertainty about the significance. And the uncertainty I'm talking about here is not the uncertainty that comes from model misspecification and all the rest of it, which is very important, but it's a whole extra layer on top of things. I'm just interested at the moment in the uncertainty that comes about because we don't see the latent variables. That because we only see some variables at some higher level, which give us some probability distribution for our latent variables, but we don't observe the underlying latent variables. I'm going to introduce it's in the context today of a very simple example, a very classical example, which everybody knows about, although it turns out to be more interesting than you might think, just testing association of 2x2 stable, binary variables. First I'm going to do it without the latent variables. So first I'm just going to do the classical 2x2 table. Suppose that we have pairs of binary random variables, xi and yi, each one is either 0 or 1. So xi is 0, 1, yi is 0, 1, 1's one dimension of my 2x2 table, and the other is the other dimension of my 2x2 table. I haven't switched notation on you, I promise I haven't switched notation on you. Xi is going to be the one that is later going to be the latent variable, x will be the latent variable. But for now, I'm going to pretend that I can actually observe it, and say what we can do in that case. So, again, everybody knows what a 2x2 table is, but I wanted to show this one just to point out that in a 2x2 table, we tend to just think 2x2 table, very easy, Pearson's chi-squared, that's all there is to it. In fact, there really are three levels, three underlying distributions that come into a 2x2 table. There's the marginal distribution for x, x is 0 or 1. There's the marginal distribution for y. And then there is the dependence between x and y, the thing that we're trying to test, which in this simple 2x2 table can be expressed if I know the probability that they're both 1. And under my null hypothesis, the independence of x and y, that is simply the probability that the joint probability of being 1 is just the product of those two marginal probabilities. When I have my data, my binary random variables, then I can write it in this form. My sum of my xi, xi is 0 or 1, is just the count of the number of x's that are equal to 1. And this is the count of the numbers that are equal to 0. The count of the y's that are equal to 1, the count of the y's that are equal to 0. I should have put an n in here, somehow it got left out. And then the count of the ones that are both 1, which I can just write as the sum of the xi, yi. That will be the count of the number of pairs for which xi and yi are both 1. And there are, in fact, 4 different possible ways to think about testing dependence in this 2x2 table. The classical way that comes about in Fisher's exact tests, and asymptotically they all come down to Pearson's chi-squared, but we're interested in the exact tests. Thank you. Is that we can condition on the, conditional on the margins, conditional on the number of x's equal to 1, conditional on the number of y's equal to 1. That's just your hypergeometric distribution, which, with apologies to Dr. Seuss, I always think of as the one fish, two fish, tag fish, new fish distribution. It's the distribution that comes out when you have some number n fish in a pond. You take some sample, the x's, for example, go back to our 2x2 table. And we'll take a sample of some number of fish, this number of fish, we tag them, we put them back in the pond, and then we take another random sample of some other number of fish and look at the number within that sample that are tagged. Okay? And that is just your standard hypergeometric distribution, which is familiar to most of you. The reason why one uses that distribution is that, of course, because we're conditioning on the margin, it is any test that's based on that distribution is robust. We don't need to assume a marginal model there. But if I have a marginal model for my models, then I actually get more information if I use it. If I have a model for my y's, then I can test conditional on the x's, and that will be robust to the marginal model for the x's. In fact, in the examples that I am going to talk about, it's going to be the latent variables, the x's, for which I have a good model for, a model we can actually believe. And in that case, it makes sense to condition on the y's. So I can do a test, I can use my marginal model for the x's, but condition on the y's, and have a test that's robust to the marginal model for the y's. Or one can think about the full model, the unconditional model, which uses both the marginal models for x and y. And of course, as one conditions less, one gets things that are more, as you condition less, you get things that are less robust, but more powerful. In fact, to simplify things a bit, I went straight to the example that does come out in the genetic example, an example I'm going to talk about, which means we have a little bit less to think about. In the case that I'm interested in, or in this rather special version of the more general problems I'm interested in, we do have a good model for the x's. And in fact, because of Mendel's first law, which I'll explain how it relates to Mendel's first law in a moment, we have a model that actually says the marginal distribution for the x's is simply 50-50. So in that case, in my 2x2 table, we can get something that's robust to the marginal distribution of y in any case. Because if I look at my little 2x2 table, and to find z to be 1, sorry, z, I'm in Canada, z is 1 if x is y, if x and y are in agreement, and z is 0 if x and y are in disagreement, then under the null hypothesis, the probability that z is 1 is a half p1 plus a half p0, so regardless of p1 and p0, it's just equal to a half. So in this very special case, whether you do conditional on y or not doesn't actually make any difference if I use the test statistic z. So if I use the test statistic that counts up the number of agreements, the number of pairs that are both 1 or both 0, press that way if you like, then I actually have a test that is already robust to the marginal distribution of y. So this is where it relates to those of you who are more related to genetics and want something to hang it on in terms of the genetic example. This is where it relates back. Those of you who'd rather just think about the 2x2 table, that's equally fine too. But for those of you who want a genetic example to hang it on, here's where it comes from. the very simplest linkage design, experimental design, where I have an experimental population, and so I can do design crosses. I have two, let's call them mice, doesn't really matter what they are. I have two inbred lines of mice, which I've called inbred line 1 and inbred line 0. The way a bat cross experiment works is that first of all you make a cross between your two lines of mice and have a hybrid mouse, which is this one. We'll come back and say a bit more about him in a moment. Then you cross him back to a mouse from one of the two lines. Here I cross that mouse back to a mouse from the inbred line 0, and then we look at all the offspring. We're interested in some trait, so the trait here is a trait that I really don't have a model for, I think it's somewhat genetic. I know it's more prevalent in inbred line 1, but I don't want to assume a specific genetic model. It might be a quite complicated trait. It just so happens in my little example that the inbred line 1 guy does have it, and the hybrid mouse happens to have it. What I'm interested in is who has it among the mice here. Those are the ones shaded black here. And that's going to be it's a binary trait in this example. So YI is the ones who have that particular trait. But again, I don't want to assume a genetic model, any specific model for that binary Y. But what I am prepared to assume a model for is the way that the basic DNA is inherited. So the XI is going to denote DNA marker types in this little experiment. So my hybrid mouse has chromosomes. My hybrid mouse is the offspring of a chromosome, so because it's the offspring of line 1 and line 0, it's a cross between line 1 and line 0. Every part of its genome, it has one chromosome that comes from inbred line 1 and one chromosome that comes from inbred line 0. And such hybrid mouse, I'm going to denote by X equals 1. X equals 1 doesn't mean being inbred 1. It means having a chromosome, a pair of chromosomes that are from one of each, one from the inbred line 1 and the other one from inbred line 0. And I can look assuming I can type the DNA, I can look at the DNA, I can actually type my offspring mice. My offspring mice will all have one chromosome from the inbred line 0 from them, in this little picture, their mother mouse, and their other chromosome that are at any particular position in the genome will be the inbred line 1 with probability half, and the line 0 type DNA with probability half. So this is just a concrete example of that 2x2 table. And then median genetics is the thing that tells us that at any particular position in the genome, any particular marker, there's a 50-50 chance that this individual will hand on the line 1 chromosome, this line 1 DNA, versus the line 0 DNA. And Z is just written for this particular little example. Z is 1, remember, if X is Y, and 0 if X is not equal to Y. Or to put it back in the 2x2 table, for those of you who just want to think about the 2x3 table and don't want to think about the mice, this is just a little example of a 2x2 table. I'm going to assume that the probability that XI is 1 is equal to half. I actually put it in my little realization. Half of them are 1 and half of them are 0. And that's just what I happen to draw. And for this particular little example, the sum of the ZI, the number of agreements, happens to be 7 out of 10. Now, under this model, under the null hypothesis, assuming this model for X, but not needing to assume any model for Y, because I've constructed a situation, a test statistic that's robust to the model for Y, all I'm doing is testing whether the probability that ZI is equal to 1 is equal to a half, which is the null hypothesis of independence between X and Y, versus the alternative that there is a positive association, there is the probability of an agreement is bigger than a half. And because of the way I constructed it, this is just a binomial random variable. And just to remind everybody what a p-value is simply the probability that under the null hypothesis, I observe a value. I'm going to reject the null hypothesis in favor of the alternative if the number of agreements is large. So that the p-value is simply going to be the probability under the null hypothesis of getting a value at least as large as that observed. Where my null hypothesis is simply tossing a fair coin. So about the simplest example one can have in statistics. And for this very simple example of the little one that I drew, where t is 7 and n is 10, the p-value turns out to be 0.172. Since Yanming D and I were busily working on separate examples, we ended up with some slightly different examples when we pulled them all together. Another example that I'm going to draw some pictures for a bit later on just happens to be the one where I have 30 offspring mice, or 30 binary pairs in my 2x2 table. In that case, it turns out that 20 is actually a very convenient critical value, because the p-value turns out to be just about that 0.05. So that if I'm doing in terms of p-values, and I observe 20 agreements out of 30, the p-value will be 0.05. If I want to turn it into a hypothesis test, then I want to use the classical 0.05 cutoff level, type 1 error level, then I will reject the null hypothesis if t is greater than or equal to 20. That will give me a test of just about type 1 error rate, 0.05. Of course, in general, and in fact, even in this case, because it's not exactly 0.05, one will actually need to do a randomized test. In all our examples or our computations of power functions and so on, we do the randomized test, but I'm not going to dwell on the randomization because that's not the point of the talk. Charlie Geyer has worked on these fuzzy p-values in contexts where the discreteness of the random variables and the randomized test that comes from that is the point of the talk, but that's not the point of this talk. When I talk about the randomness, it's going to come from the fact that I have latent variables, not because of the discreteness of my random variables. So going back to what we said earlier, that there are four different ways to condition, this is just reminding you again of exactly the same thing, that we could condition on both margins if we wanted to, and as I said, in the binary case, that's just the hypergeometric distribution. You can also think of it as a permutation test, which I probably refer to as a permutation test. If I think of my vector of y's and my beta vector of x's, and think of commuting the x's against the y's, then that's again exactly the same test. So I will probably call it a permutation test in some cases. And because it's conditional on the margins, conditional on the number of x's that are equal to 1, the number of y's that are equal to 1, it is robust to the marginal distributions. I mentioned this one earlier. If I had a model for the y, I could use that model for the y and condition on the x's, but actually that's although I will show you the power function for that one, because Yanming D computed it for us. I point out that in our context, that's not a very sensible one to do, because what I want is something that is robust to the marginal distribution of y. If I do have a model that for my x's, as I do, and condition on the y's, then I can do that version of the test. In that case, in this particular example, where I'm using this number of agreements as my test statistic, in fact, whether I condition on the y's or do the unconditional, it's the same, because I've got this test statistic that is robust to the marginal distribution of y. So in fact, these end up being the same test in this particular example. But in general, this way of thinking about it gives me something that is robust to the marginal distribution of y. The general one, of course, would not be robust to the marginal distribution of y. It's only because I've got a statistic that takes into account, that gives me a null distribution, that gives me a null distribution that does not depend on the value of y. But in fact, in this particular simple example, these two end up being the same thing. Okay, this is Yanming D's picture, and I have to get my notes in order to make sure I can explain it right. It's just trying to explain the difference between these three tests. Essentially three tests. Because again, the one conditional on y and the unconditional one turn out to be the same. So because in order to be able to draw the picture, we've just gone back to just five observations. Obviously one doesn't do the test with just five observations, but that's the easiest way to think about the picture. And so here we have all the possible values of everything. The groups correspond to the possible values of the sum of the xi, the number of x's equal to 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. On the horizontal axis in each grid, you have the sum of the yi, going from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And on the vertical axis, you have the number of agreements, the sum of the zi, or the statistic t. So overall here, we have all the possibilities. A lot of those possibilities are impossible. and the white squares actually correspond to the impossible squares. Some of them are rather light gray, those are not impossible, it's the ones that are truly white that are the impossible squares. For example, if all the x's are equal to 1, then the sum of the xiyi, the number of agreements, t has got to be equal to y, so it's only the diagonal that was possible. And in general, one has some pattern of squares that are possible and impossible. The shading in the possible squares corresponds to the likelihood ratio. The likelihood ratio for testing against an alternative, if you took a particular alternative to get the numbers, but in general, you're going to want to reject for larger values of t, you're going to want to reject the lighter squares first. Okay? And the green, blue, and red correspond to these three tests. The green one is the unconditional test. That is, you just reject for some large value of t. The green, we want to reject the lighter squares, the ones up the top. So we're going to reject for t larger than some value. And again, it's not exactly on a cell line, which implies that we are, in fact, using a randomized test. It's almost on a cell line, because it was fairly close to just rejecting when t was equal to 5, but not exactly. The blue one is the one that conditions on the sum of the xi. That is, you have to have the same line, you have to reject, regardless of the value of y, the sum of the yi, you reject at the same level across everyone, but at different levels within each square. That means sometimes you're having to reject, to get the right size of test, a larger portion of some slightly more shaded, darker square. Sometimes you seem to do rather better than the green one. We'll see exactly how it works out in the end. The interesting one is the permutation test, the red test. There I'm conditioning on the sum of the xi, that is the grid, and on the sum of the yi, that is which column I'm in. Therefore, to get a test of the right size, I have to reject the right portion of every column. That means sometimes I can get away with rejecting only very light stuff, but sometimes I have to reject quite dark stuff in order to get a test of the right size. So again, this is the red line that tells me that the cutoff point in for this value of the sum of the xi, this value for the sum of the yi, this is the sum of the xi equals 2, the sum of yi equals 4, I would have to reject a portion of the time when t equals 3, which is really quite a dark square. Here, even darker. And that does of course affect the power. Oh, okay, that's just everything I just said. Hopefully I got it right. So when we look at the power of the test, we actually find that the green and blue test, this is done for two different type 1 errors levels, the picture I showed you was actually for alpha equals 0.05, I think. It's just saying the things I said before, the more we condition, the less powerful the test. The green and the blue actually end up very similar anyhow. But the point I wanted to make is that the permutation test, the one that conditions on both the margins, if I have a good marginal model, does use me power. So that if I do have a good model for my x's, I want to use it. Okay. Now, finally. latent variables. So now I have my good model for my x's, but unfortunately I don't observe my x's. So that again, this relates to some much more general questions that I'm talking about tomorrow. We don't actually observe the underlying inheritance of the DNA, but here it's just relating to the binary 2x2 table, so I need to put some uncertainty on the x's. I no longer observe the x's. Because I'm thinking about this very simple case where the x's are essentially equivalent to the z's, under the null hypothesis, my model for the x's is that my x's are 50-50. Under my null hypothesis, my model for the z's is a 50-50. In order to make it, again, somewhat easier to talk about, I've actually, in these examples, put in the uncertainty on the z's rather than on the x's. So what I'm assuming now is that we don't observe the z's. If I observe the x's and the y's, I do observe the y's. If I observe the x's and the y's, then I'm observing the z's. Now we're assuming we're not observing the z's, but only some error-prone version of the z's. So even when z is 1, I can observe z. So v is what I do observe, v to be 0. even when g is 0, I could observe v to be 1. But I'm assuming that I do actually know those error probabilities. And again, it's slightly artificial in this example, but again, that is the situation that arises in genetics. We basically do know from our model for our DNA and our markers, we usually have a good model for the probability of what we do observe given the underlying DNA. In our simple little example, because I know this model and because I can actually compute the full distribution for my Z's, the Z's are also just binary random variables and I compute them. So again, in this simple little example, the simple example of the 2x2 table, I actually know the distributions and I can compute them and I will compute them and I'll show you the power functions. But in general, we can't. For much more general problems, don't know the distribution of the Z. So the standard approach that is widely used, again, in a very, certainly in the genomics area, but in a very wide area, a set of scientific latent variable problems, is that you have a test statistic that you would really like to use that is a function of your latent variables. So the statistic that you do end up using is a sensible one, it's a perfectly sensible thing to do, is to say, okay, what's the expected value of my latent test statistic given what I do observe? Right? Makes a sensible test statistic. Sometimes we can compute it. In our examples, we can compute it. In many examples, you can't compute it. But so long as I can simulate X given what I do observe, the latent variables given what I do observe, which one can very often do, then indeed one can get at least a Monte Carlo estimate of your test statistic. But the problem is once you've even got, and in our example we can actually compute it, it turns out to be the test statistic is just a sort of shrunken version. Our latent test statistic was the sum of the ZI. This thing turns out to be just the sum of the WI, where these are just scaled versions of the Z's. But in general, first, I might have problems computing it. Secondly, in order to get a p-value, in order to do any testing, I need a distribution for it, right? Again, I don't want to use a permutation. Even on a more complicated data structure, a permutation test is often not an option anyhow. Even where it is an option, as I pointed out, I'd really rather not use a permutation test. I'd really like to use my model for the latent variables in order to do the testing. So first we have problems, as I said right at the beginning, and here's where we come back to it. We have problems, first of all, computing our test statistics, and secondly, finding a distribution for them that will enable us to test hypotheses. There's basically only one thing we know about the distribution. One thing we do know about the distribution is its expectation under the null hypothesis. We do know that the expectation of a conditional expectation is just the expectation of my latent test statistic, which, again, in my simple example, it's a half. But in general, if I can simulate my latent test statistic, I do know the distribution of the latent test statistic, so I can find the null expectation of the test statistic I want to use. But I don't know anything else. I don't even know the variance. All I know about the variance is that the variance of the conditional expectation is less than the variance of the latent statistic, because the variance of a conditional expectation is going to be smaller than the variance of the random variable, overall variance of the random variable. This is just a numerical example, which in the interest of time, I will skip. All it does is say, okay, how would this work if in fact my error probabilities were actually fairly large, Q1 is 0.3, Q0 is 0.2, and it just takes you through Bayes' theorems and computing those expectations, which for the statisticians amongst you I don't need to do. But actually I will just point out that the statistic you end up with, the test statistic you're going to use, is a shrunken version, shrunken in this case by almost a half of the original random variable. And so your little tests that people would tend to use, again, they would be doing it in more complicated situations where they couldn't actually work this out. If they could work this out, obviously they'd use the right distribution. But in more complicated cases where you can't work out this distribution, essentially what you're doing is using a test statistic that has a smaller variance, that has the right mean under the null hypothesis, but has a smaller variance than the latent test statistic. And there it is. It has the right mean under the null hypothesis, but it has a variance that in this particular example is shrunk by a factor of about 4. So this is going back to the example I had where of just a straight binomial random variable where n is 30. And the power of that test that I showed you way back, I won't go back to it now. The power of the test, if I can actually observe my latent variables, my straight binomial, looks something like this. If I construct a test of type 1 error 0.05, the power for test with a sample size of n equals 30, for testing theta, the probability that z is 1 equals a half, against larger values of theta, here up to 0.8 or thereabouts, looks like that upper curve. Obviously, we're going to lose power if we can't observe the x's. But in this simple example, I can see how much power I would actually lose. I can actually use the correct distribution for my test statistic by W, because I can compute it in this particular example. And in this particular example, we find that the critical value is that the sum of the VI is equal to 18, is the critical value. You do need a randomized test here. You need about a 50% chance to get a size, test of size exactly 0.05. You need to reject the probability close to a half when the V's are equal to 18. The power of that test is the one that says true distribution, this one here. Note it has the right size, so using the correct distribution. We have lost a lot of power. That's the inevitable loss of power from the fact that we don't observe X, we only observe this other version of X. So we shouldn't ever really do better than the best test based on this true distribution. So why does that other one look as though the one we're doing a bit better? Something that some people have suggested doing, again, not in this very simple example, but in somewhat analogous cases, is to say, okay, we know that this is a very conservative test, let's actually get an estimate, a Monte Carlo estimate, usually, of the correct variance of my test statistic. And I still don't know anything about this distribution, but we always use normal approximation, so let's use a normal approximation. So let's use a normal approximation to our test statistic and use the correct variance. That one looks as though we've increased the power, but it's obviously, in this particular example, it's a rather a bad thing to do. We can't actually do better than do the best test with the true distribution. And the only reason why we look as though we're getting a little bit more power is that we've now got a fairly substantially anti-conservative test. Our type 1 error is too large. That's not a good idea. The other thing that's done quite broadly is to say, okay, well, we don't know the true variance. All I know is that the true variance of my test statistic is less than the variance of this one. The variance of my latent test statistic is something I can estimate or compute quite accurately in many, many cases. So what, again, has been done in analogous, more complicated examples is, again, to use normal approximations, often use normal approximations to these test statistics, but use the larger variance, which we do know under the null hypothesis, the variance of this t. That obviously, since we assume a larger variance than the true one, is going to tend to give us a conservative distribution, and in this case it's very strongly conservative. Our type 1 error is way too small, and we lose almost all our power for this example. And in general, if there is a lot of uncertainty about the latent variables, you will lose a lot of power. So obviously, there are some problems. And in the final few minutes, which I don't have too long now, but in the final few minutes, I want to say how Charlie Geyer and I have developed methods to address this problem. So very quickly, what we've seen is that we may not know the distribution of our test statistic, and even if we can simulate it, you may get yourself an empirical p-value, but that can be very computationally intensive, and it may involve you in simulating things that, re-simulating things where you're not entirely certain about the model, and where you'd really like tests that were robust. Re-simulating data random variables can be very non-robust. But if I can simulate my latent variables given what I do see, and I may very often do that in actually just in order to compute my test statistic of this form may be computed by Monte Carlo by simulating my latent variables given what I see. If I do that, then I have an empirical distribution of this latent test statistic given all the data, rather than just the expectation. Okay? And I can look at the distribution of this latent test statistic given what I see. And I'll come back to that final point a bit later. So the idea of the fuzzy p-value as applied to these latent variable problems is the following. Let me first of all pretend I could observe t. So that's why I did it, was careful going through that 2x2 table, pretending I could observe the x's. If I do that, I pretend I observe the random variable t, I can get a p-value, that same p-value I got for the binomial distribution way back. In this context, and again, Charlie Geyer and Glenn Needham have developed things in other contexts, but the simple way to do it in this context is to think of the fuzzy p-value as a random, simply as a random variable, which has the distribution of the p-value of the latent test, where the latent test statistic has the distribution has its conditional distribution given the data that you observe. That makes much more sense than just computing a statistic that's your latent test statistic given what you observe. It says do it on the p-value scale. Take the p-value given what you observe and take the distribution of the p-value given what you observe. And the nice thing about that is that it doesn't require nearly so much Monte Carlo. It just requires getting this latent test statistic, which in more complicated examples you might need to simulate t under h0. In our case we didn't, because it was just a binomial distribution. And it does require simulation, in our case, simple example, simple computation of the distribution of t given z, given what I do observe, to get the fuzzy p distribution. But it doesn't require any simulation of the data random variables. Neither the x, the ones that are the fuzzy version of the x's, the error-prone version of the x's, or of the y's. That we condition on both those. Everything is conditional on the observed data. All we're simulating are the latent variables given the observed data. In our simple binomial example, this very simple example, for the numbers that I used with that rather error-prone version that I gave you, remember that z equals 18 was the critical value for that binomial distribution. And if I just took v equals 18, the p-value for that true binomial distribution, the true p-value, because I can work it out in this case, is actually 0.07 or thereabouts. For 19, it's 0.03, so that 0.05 is somewhere between the two. But the fuzzy p-value distribution is a random variable. This is a cumulative distribution function of that random variable, and at v equals 18, and it's just plotted up, of course. In principle, it goes all the way from 0 to 1. We're only interested in small p-values of around 0.05, maybe, or maybe up to 0.1. So I've just plotted it up to 0.2. So this is the distribution of the fuzzy p-value for that example. How should I interpret that distribution? So I'm saying, rather than that p-value, which in general I can't compute anyhow, this is how you should express the evidence. This probability distribution is how you should express the evidence. Well, a fuzzy p-value is really no more difficult to interpret than a regular p-value. If we think about the following two points. First of all, suppose that it wasn't fuzzy. Suppose V, my actual observed data, did actually determine the x's exactly. Then it would reduce to a degenerate distribution. In fact, in this case, it would reduce to the degenerate distribution p equals 0.071. How spread out this distribution is, giving you a measure of the uncertainty in the latent variables, uncertainty in the sense of the strength of the evidence, uncertainty in the p-value that comes from the fact that V does not determine X exactly. If V told us nothing at all about the latent variables, in which case it wouldn't be a very good test statistic, but in that extreme case where V tells us nothing at all about the latent variables, then the fuzzy p distribution reduces to a uniform 0-1 distribution. So this is the CDF of a uniform 0-1. So in general, you're going to be somewhere between the two, an exact p-value, because V tells you everything there is to know about X, and the uniform 0-1 distribution, where V tells you nothing at all about X. And again, how spread out this distribution is telling you how uncertain you are as to your evidence, because of the uncertainty about the latent variables. Again, everything is conditional on V, conditional on Y, conditional on the observed data. The randomness is simply coming from the latent variables. And I don't know what one might want to report, but one might, for example, report the probability that the fuzzy P was less than 0.05, or if you didn't want to draw the whole curve. In fact, if you want to convert it to a test, that's probably what you have to do. One test, which will have the right size, if you want to test the size, type 1 error 0.05, then one way to do it is simply to compute your fuzzy P distribution, and your test is then to reject with the probability that the fuzzy P random variable is less than 0.05, which was about 0.65 for P equals 18 in that curve on the previous page. This is not a very powerful test. In fact, if I look at the power, the power, at least out of the extremes, is not so different from the conservative test that I had several pages back now. Okay. But unlike this one, it has the right size. So down here where you're close, it does have the type 1 error 0.05. So that is, we certainly do have the type 1 error 0.05. And to get a power function that's actually somewhere between the conservative and the true. Remember, we can never do better than the true. Get back here now. We should be coming to the conclusions. Yes, I should conclude. Yes, this is not that powerful a test, but we have a lot of uncertainty. Just, in our opinion, not right. So, two pages of conclusions very quickly. I'm just summarizing what I'm saying. That in genetic examples and in many other examples, we may have a good model for the DNA inheritance, but traits can be very complicated things. And so that we want tests that are robust to our trait model. In the case of our binary data, a permutation test is robust to both your marginal distributions, but on more complicated data structures, permutation is very often not an option, so you can't get valid permutation tests. And also, the permutation test, because it conditions on both the X's and the Y's, when I observe the X's and the Y's, that does lose us some power. And the alternative that we prefer, is to use the model for the X's, so you get additional power re-simulate X under the null hypothesis to obtain an empirical distribution for conditional on Y. We do want to condition on Y. But then we get the problem that is the new part that is the more interesting and to us at the moment more exciting part, that in fact these X's that we now have a nice model for, we may not be able to see them. And the data that we can see can actually be quite an imperfect reflection of the underlying latent variables. And if we base our p-values in the classical way on statistics constructed from the data, it's not only computationally intensive, but because we have to assume some model, it may not be very robust. And the real reason I got into this is that it's the Z's, it's the latent variables that are telling you about the model and the data that are telling you about the Z's. And if I simply integrate over those latent variables, I'm confounding the evidence in the Z's with the uncertainty about the Z's. And that's what I don't want to do. And the fuzzy p-values, of which this is a simple example, and about which I'll talk in a more general genetics context tomorrow, a likelihood-based context tomorrow, the fuzzy p-values address those issues. It takes the uncertainty in the latent variables into account, but it doesn't just look at the uncertainty in the latent variables, it puts that uncertainty directly onto the p-value scale, which is what we think is the way to express evidence and uncertainty in these types of problems. Thank you.